Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Everyone, welcome to this first episode on the most important battles of the Civil War. We'll be covering a lot in this first episode, the first Bull Run, but then also the background to the Civil War. What were the issues in the United States in its early years? The divisions that were never completely healed between the North and the South that ultimately led to the Civil War. But before we get into all that historical context, I figure it's useful to mention where James and I are coming from on this issue. So for me, I'm from Iowa. We are in the North, but I have to say for a lot of people, the Civil War is a lot like World War I. You might find a few oddballs here and there that know all of the battles, have even collected vintage equipment or vintage rifles from it, but your average person wouldn't know anything about it. There's a few Underground Railroad houses, but unless you're a elementary school student dragged there on a field trip, you're probably not going to go there. So I come to this as a newcomer, and you might hear this in our discussion where I'm a little bit confused and dumbfounded by things. Listeners of the podcast are probably used to that by now. But James, for you, you are much more of a Civil War enthusiast. So what got you into this topic?
Well, yeah, Scott, I'll tell you the story. When I was an undergraduate, I went to UT Austin, and my undergraduate degree is actually in electrical engineering. So I do not have a bachelor's in history. But I've always enjoyed history, and when it got time to take my required history course, everybody has to take 6 hours of history in the state of Texas at university. And I didn't want to just take a survey course because, number one, they tend to be really big and you don't really interact much with the professor. And number two, I just didn't want to hit, I teach a survey nowadays and you spend like 10 minutes on anything if you cover it at all. So I wanted to do something else in more depth. And I found out from a friend that you could fulfill your history requirement by taking an upper level, like a junior, senior level course, and it could be on a specific topic. So I flipped through the catalog, and I saw they had a course called The Coming of the Civil War, 1828 to 1861. And I said, yes, that is what I want to take. And I took the course, and I had the most amazing professor. He was just a storyteller. He would go up there and just talk, and I would be sitting there on the edge of my seat. He was a master storyteller. I'm scribbling notes the whole time and just enthralled. He was so good. And in fact, in the room where the class was held, there was a bell that indicated the end of the class. And so we'd be going along and all of a sudden ring. And I'd look over there and think, what, already? It's over? Because it felt like it was like 10 minutes as opposed to my engineering courses, a lot of which I looked at my watch every 2 minutes and thought it was going backwards at times. But so I just love that course so much. And it just so happened that I went into the co-op program. I was working every semester and then going back to school and then working full time. So I wasn't able to take the companion course, the Civil War and Reconstruction, until almost 3 years later. But in the meantime, I just started buying every Civil War book I could get my hand on and reading them. And I was just reading these Civil War books. I was just learning everything I could about the Civil War. And then my senior year, I did take the companion course, which is every bit as good as the previous course. And I even got into reenacting a little bit. I did a reenactment of one Battle of Palmito Ranch, which occurred in Texas. And then I did kind of one of these meet and greet things where you go to a museum and there's a bunch of reenactors. I was one of the reenactors. But so, yeah. And then after I graduated from college and I went into the engineering field, I got a job as an engineer. I continued studying the Civil War. And it was around that time that the Ken Burns series came out, the groundbreaking PBS series on the Civil War. And it just really continued to fan the flames. And I've just continued to love the Civil War ever since then.
I'm starting to appreciate it more because I live in Kansas City, which was quite literally a war zone and some of the worst guerrilla fighting and insurgency actions. It makes Afghanistan look tame, which we'll get into.
Oh, yeah.
But that's a factor, too, that these are battle sites here in the United States. You can be a World War II buff, and there are many, and that's great, but you have to go overseas. Here, you would see this is where a factory was repurposed into a wartime production facility for tanks. And there's something different about actually seeing a Civil War battle site that you can experience, especially if you're really anywhere east of the Mississippi and particularly in the South. So we'll get into a lot of this, of how the past touches the present. And there are many issues about the Civil War that are not resolved today, as we saw with the whole imbroglio last year about Civil War statues. So in some ways, these issues are much more alive than even more recent wars. But let's not just go back to the Civil War. Let's go decades before that and really start at the beginning. So, James, can you lay the groundwork? Why was this issue not resolved in the framing of the Constitution when it seemed like a lot of other heavily contested issues were resolved, like representation and other social issues?
Sure. Let's talk about the concept of the Union in general. At the time of the Constitutional Convention, you still had slavery legal in some northern states, but it was clearly on its way out. It was just dying a natural death because the climate, the soil, and everything up north is just not suitable for a plantation-based slave economy. And so, but in the South, of course, it was. And the United States of America almost did not happen, at least, or it almost split from the beginning. We tend to think of secession and disunion as strictly a 1860-1861 thing, but even in the Constitutional Convention, there were some Northerners who wanted to, here's what they wanted. They did not want slaves to be counted in the population of the Southern states. They said, these people are not going to vote. They're not citizens. You don't give them any rights. Why should they be counted towards your population? If you're going to act as if only white people are full citizens of the United States, then only white people should count. And the Southerners said, no, we think we should count the slaves. And the Southern states almost bolted. And had they done that, you might have had two nations from the very beginning. But in the end, as most of our listeners know, the framers of the Constitution worked out what's called the Three-Fifths Compromise, where every slave counts as three-fifths of a person. That's kind of a weird formula. Whenever I tell my students that, they think, that's random. Why three-fifths? Why not one-half or something? But anyway, so what happens is the slave population, they would count it up and multiply it by three-fifths, and that would be added to the white population to get the total state population in the South. And that what that does is it gives the South excessively high power in the federal government. In other words, they get more representation in Congress than they would if only the white people were counted. And throughout American history, from that time, from the Constitutional Convention down to the Civil War, there had been several times when secession was mentioned or threatened. It never was real serious, but there were a couple of examples, like in 1814 at the Hartford Convention, there were some radical Federalists in the North who were opposed to the War of 1812, and they were talking about leaving the United States. That's, by the way, the North seceding. And then 1828, you had the nullification controversy when the state of South Carolina threatened to nullify a federal law and even possibly secede. So one way, in addition to the Three-Fifths Compromise, which was basically the Constitutional Convention kicking the can down the road for a future generation, it didn't solve the problem, obviously. It just put it off, the conflict over slavery. What happened is that the North and the South kept a balance of the number of states. Okay, so if a free state came in, then a slave state would come in to balance it out. Or if two free states came in, then two slave states would also come in. The population in the North grew much more quickly than the population in the South did. And so that naturally led to the House of Representatives having more northern representatives than southern representatives. But by keeping the number of states balanced between slave and free states, that kept the Senate balanced. So this half the senators were from free states and half were from slave states. And that gave the South kind of a veto power, because you couldn't get a law through the Senate if it was too hostile to Southern interests.
That's a good point. And also, this issue of slavery is something that I think the founders really knew that they were sweeping under the rug, the way that after World War I, many statesmen realized that this was going to erupt again in 20 years. So there were, I mean, from what I've been researching about slavery in the United States, many of the founding fathers acknowledged that slavery violated core American principles of liberty and the pursuit of happiness, because you think, how could Thomas Jefferson write these things himself when he himself was owning slaves and exploiting them? And this contradiction is among them, and it's even in individuals. So in his initial draft of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, he condemns the slave trade. But his workaround of, okay, well, then why are there slaves in America? He blames the presence of enslaved Africans on British colonial policies. So he acknowledges the natural right of the enslaved, but he also said Americans are absolved for any responsibility of this happening. Well, yeah. So the Constitutional Convention, the Continental Congress rejects this language because they have to have a big house for Southerners as well to get through the Revolution and hammer out the architecture for the nation. And but even among the founders, they didn't know how this was going to go on. So Washington manumits his slaves after he dies, and he thought that blacks and whites might live together as free people. Jefferson instead thought that Africans could go somewhere else, because he believed in innate differences in the races and had deeply held prejudices despite his Enlightenment ideas. So there's an ambiguous legacy of slavery left behind by the founders in the 1830s. And for all that they did to clarify questions of the Constitution and the structure of government, which is still being used today and still inspires constitutional law cases, I think they knew that there was something very messy and a very big mess they swept under the rug, and it was going to rear its ugly head soon. And it did.
Yeah, absolutely. People like Washington and Jefferson, even though they owned slaves, they weren't happy about it, as you alluded to. This was not really true in the Deep South. The people from Georgia, South Carolina, they didn't have a problem with it at all, really. But there was this famous quote from Jefferson where he said slavery was like having a wolf by the ears, which I think is a great picture. You know, you're holding this wolf, and you're really not happy about the fact that you're holding a wolf by the ears. But you also can't let him go, right? Because you'll get chewed up. So these guys realized that if they were to get rid of slavery, they would lose their livelihood. And so, you know, people, the plantation owners, if they'd lost all their slaves, well, gee, what are they going to do? Go out and dig in the dirt themselves? Not likely. So their entire livelihood totally depended on having these people work for them for free. And then we start to see in the 1830s, early 1830s, it was a gradual process, but it really comes out in the open. The abolitionist movement really gets going in the North. William Lloyd Garrison, a Northern abolitionist, begins to publish a paper called The Liberator, and he uses very strong language to condemn slavery and Southerners who hold slavery, or anyone who disagrees with him about anything, pretty much. But Garrison and other abolitionists, including some who were had run away from slavery and freed themselves with their own feet, basically. And they became abolitionists, people like Frederick Douglass, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, others. They start making speeches. Abolitionists start sending literature to the South to try to persuade Southerners to change their mind on slavery. And of course, the Southerners end up just unconstitutionally stealing this stuff, basically, is the best way to put it, censoring the mails and things like that. But it causes a backlash. The Southern leaders become very defensive because these abolitionists are saying that anybody who holds slaves is ungodly, is evil, and we've got to get rid of this institution. So Southerners shift and they move away from this idea that slavery was a necessary evil, you know, having a wolf by the ears. And by the 1830s, 1840s, they're starting to say, no, actually slavery is a positive good. And we see this in a speech made by John C. Calhoun, a famous Southern leader, Southern senator. He'd served in the cabinet of more than one president. He was vice president under John Quincy Adams and Andrew Jackson. He butted heads with Jackson and he ended up leaving. But he made a speech and said it was the natural and good condition of the African race to be slaves. And so they started saying things like, well, we take care of them. We give them free food, free housing, free clothing, free medical care. Look at your factory workers up in the north. Y'all pay them terribly. They're in rotten, horrible conditions. So the slaves actually have it really, really good. Of course, they had a hard time explaining why they keep running away, which that begins to happen a lot, especially in the 1850s.
And this is a really big idea of how economics can affect politics and culture and even some people's conceptions of morality. So what I've researched on slavery, there's an interesting question that historians wrestle with of when you get to the height of the slave trade of chattel slavery from the 1600s to 1800s, at the exact same time, you have the Enlightenment happening, but you also have these complex theories of race, of talking about the innate inferiority of the African race, when centuries earlier, you really didn't have this. Of course, you had enslavement, mm-hmm. but not on these starkly racial terms. And some historians think, well, Africans were simply the most easy people to enslave. So this justification came after the fact. And if somehow Chinese people were as easy to enslave, then you would have seen similar narratives about the Chinese. And this factor, too, getting back into the 1830s of the importance of economics, there's two different visions of the North and the South of development, where with the North, the view of, like, let's say Alexander Hamilton, his vision is to transform America into an industrial powerhouse that could take on Britain and invest in manufacturing and invest in infrastructure and roads and bridges and canals and railroads. And in that way, that's how we can economically develop. So we need tariffs in order to fund this infrastructure. With the South, they have a very lucrative cash crop of cotton. And by the 1830s, with the invention of the cotton gin, that's just exploding. And the capital investment goes into land and slaves. And they'd think, well, why are we paying for tariffs when they're not aiding our model of economic development? So for people who would say slavery is a positive good, it's a question of where the cart and the horse go of economics versus moral vision. And we're not going to get too philosophical here, but you could see how for a Southerner whose economic model and idea of how their future will develop would see this as a good thing. And for a Northerner that have no need or use for slavery, how they would see it as an evil. So economics and moral vision all get tied into this period right up to the Civil War.
Absolutely. And what really starts to make the slavery issue something that just can't be swept under the rug anymore is the fact that the United States begins to expand westward. We know, of course, that at the end of the Revolutionary War, the United States stopped at the Mississippi River. The Mississippi River was the far western boundary. Then in 1803, you had the Louisiana Purchase. President Jefferson purchased boatload of land from France, from Napoleon, and that pretty much doubled the size of the U.S. And so the plan was always from the beginning that we would eventually have more states come into the Union west of the Mississippi. You'd already had a bunch of new states that were east of the Mississippi, but not part of the original 13 come in. And everybody knew that these western territories would come in as states as well. Well, the question is, are they going to be slave states or free states? And so you had a crisis in 1820 when Missouri wanted to come in as a slave state. And that would upset the balance. And so, some people weren't happy about it. Jefferson was still alive. Jefferson said that the crisis over Missouri and just slave territory in general was like a fire bell in the night. It scared him to death, he said. Anyway, they worked it out by Henry Clay came in and worked it out by bringing in Maine as a free state. And they drew a line all the way from the southern boundary of Missouri as far west as you can go and still be in the U.S. And they said everything south of there will be open to slavery, so those could be slave states, and then everything north will be free states. Well, the problem is, if you're a southerner, you look at the map and you see that the amount above the line is huge, and it could be many, many free states, whereas the part south of the line is not that big, and a lot of that is still controlled by Spain, or actually it's Mexico at this time. Mexico declared independence from Spain in 1810, and it took a while, maybe about 10 years, to become independent fully. But as everybody knows, a few years later, in 1846, the United States went to war with Mexico. By this time, Texas had broken away from Mexico, and it had become an independent republic for several years, and then it joined the United States in 1845, bringing in a huge slave state. And then we went to war. Basically, President Polk picked a fight with Mexico, and long story short, after the war, the United States gained much more territory, not quite doubling the size of the country, but nevertheless bringing in another gigantic swath of territory, including the modern-day states of California, New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, part of Utah, part of Nevada. And so this really, really more than anything else, this gaining of this territory after the Mexican War made slavery an issue that had to be dealt with. And by this time, Southerners and Northerners are getting more and more radical, I guess, more and more stuck in their ways, in their positions. The South wanted the new territories to be open to slavery, of course, all of them, while the North wanted them all to be free. Anti-slavery Northerners hoped that if you could just bottle up slavery and if you could stop it from spreading any further west of Texas, then it eventually would just die out. So you had another compromise in 1850, also bartered by Henry Clay, at least in part. And this brought peace in the short term. But then I don't want to go over these things in detail. As we know, you could do a whole course on this, and I have been in a whole course on this. But you have things like Bleeding Kansas, where, as you mentioned before, there's basically a civil war before the Civil War in Kansas, where pro-slavery and anti-slavery forces had gun battles and guerrilla warfare and things like that. You had the Dred Scott decision, which the Supreme Court said that no blacks are not citizens of the U.S., can't vote and things like that. And the Dred Scott decision also said that Congress had no right to interfere with slavery. They couldn't ban slavery anywhere. And then you had John Brown's raid. This was, of course, John Brown was a radical anti-slavery guy who rounded up a ragtag band of just a handful of blacks, mainly whites, and tried to seize the arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, hoping that he could rally more slaves. Slaves would run away and join him. He could start an army and just march through the South and single-handedly destroy slavery with his army. But, of course, that didn't happen. He ended up being caught and being hung as a traitor. But when John Brown's raid occurred, Northerners cheered him. They said, "This is great. He's a glorious martyr for the cause." And Southerners were just shocked. How could you, this guy, you know, they didn't use this term at the time, but today they would have called it, if they were around today, they'd say he was a terrorist. This guy is like attacking federal installations and trying to incite rebellion. So, you know, just the whole thing with all the Western territories, it was kind of like the first domino that knocked over another domino and so on until, I don't want to use the word inevitable because nothing in history is ever inevitable, but it made it very, very difficult for the two sections, the North and the South, to reconcile.
One point there with the Dred Scott decision that shows the, I guess I could use the word hypocrisy, but with the idea of states' rights, both sides use it to their advantage and ignore it to their advantage in the way that today political parties will both talk about fiscal responsibility, but then they'll increase the deficit when they're in power, regardless of who it is. For the Dred Scott decision, Northerners had to participate in recapturing escaped slaves, and Northerners had to participate even if they didn't have slavery in their own state. So a Southerner was perfectly happy to invoke federalism when it meant getting his property, but then would talk about states' rights when it came to the sovereignty of their own state to enact it. So for both sides, they're happy to use these terms as they see fit. But one question for you, James, before I go to the next thing. It seems like a lot of politicians were hoping that there would be a natural death to slavery, and I think a lot of the founders hoped that as well. How did they see that happening in the South? Did they just think that there would be some sort of there'd be enough industrialization that slavery was no longer economically viable and that's how it would die?
Well, I don't know if they thought there would be a lot of industrialization, but you were already starting to see a reduction in the number of slaves and the centrality of slavery to the economy in the upper South states. So I'm talking about Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Arkansas to a certain extent. In these states, there were hundreds, if probably thousands, of slaves who had been sold down to the Deep South, because these were not the cotton states. They're not part of the cotton belt. Slaves had been used primarily for crops like tobacco. There was some cotton production, but there was already, you know, and that's where the phrase sold down the river comes from. You know, they would sell their slaves and they'd be put on a river and they'd go down and end up in some place like Louisiana or Mississippi or even Texas. So I think that some Northerners were hoping that that process would just continue, because slavery does tend to, I'm sorry, not slavery in general, but cotton production wears out the soil. And so you can't just plant cotton in one spot year after year after year. Eventually you got to move on to somewhere else. And, you know, and Southerners were talking about trying to get Cuba into the U.S. and make it a slave state, trying to take part of Mexico. You had the filibusters who were going down and just private armies that were going down and conquering Central and South American nations, trying to get them for the U.S. So those never worked out in the long run. But I think they just felt like it's almost like a wound. If we can close it off, if we can bottle it up and stop it from spreading, then it's just going to die out. So yeah.
Didn't happen though.
No, it wasn't going to, the Southerners were not going to give up very easily. Let's move on to 1860, if that's okay. Well, actually in 1856, I'm going to back up even further. You had a two-party system, the Democrats and the Whigs, from starting around 1832-36, but the Whig Party broke up over slavery. Basically, you had Southern Whigs and Northern Whigs, and the party splits, and then it just dies out. The Whig Party in the North in 1854 is replaced by the Republican Party, which is, of course, around still today. And so 1856 is the first year when you have a Republican versus a Democrat. Republicans and Democrats are the two major parties. But at that time, the Republican Party was a purely sectional party, and it didn't even exist in the South. So the first election, the first candidate of the Republican Party was actually not Abraham Lincoln, as some people think. It was John C. Fremont. We'll talk about him later some. He had been an explorer of the West. They called him the Pathfinder, Army veteran. In the North, you had basically Fremont versus Millard Fillmore, who ran as a third party candidate, the Know Nothing Party, and we don't have time to go into that. But in the South, it was just Fillmore versus the Democratic candidate. I'm sorry, not Southern, but the Democratic candidate, who was James Buchanan. Of course, James Buchanan was on the ballot in the North too, He was a Northerner, but he was a totally in the tank for the South. He basically took his orders from Southerners. Buchanan was elected. And even in 1856, one thing a lot of people don't know is that in 1856, Southerners were threatening to secede if the Republican candidate was elected. So it's kind of like a preview of 1860. Buchanan does win and is elected the presidency. But nobody's really happy about the whole situation. So we get to 1860. If I can go on to 1860 now, 4 years later. By this time, the Democrats had split. You had Stephen Douglas was the Northern Democratic candidate, but he was unacceptable to the South. The Southern Democratic Party nominated John C. Breckinridge, who was actually the sitting vice president at the time. And the issue was a federal slave code. The Southern Democrats wanted a federal law protecting slavery in all of the territories, or at least the Southwestern territories, but preferably all the territories. And as we know, the Republican Party nominates Abraham Lincoln, and Southerners threaten again, just as they had done in 1856, they threatened to secede if Lincoln were elected. And this is in spite of the fact that one thing people don't understand, Lincoln was personally opposed to slavery, but he had no intention of touching it in the South. He said, if I'm elected, I will not do anything about slavery in the South. All I insist upon is that slavery does not spread into the South, the Western territories. I don't think the Southern Democrats believed him, or at least they that wasn't good enough for them. So when we got to the election, Lincoln was elected. He only got about 40% of the popular vote, but of course the popular vote doesn't count. And he did get a majority of the Electoral College. And that's in spite of the fact that he was not even on the ballot in most Southern states. I put Northern in my notes, but that's obviously wrong. Lincoln wins just about every Northern state. And because they're so much more populous by this time, he becomes the president. And the Southerners had threatened, you know, and Northerners said, yeah, let them threaten. They've threatened this before. The Southerners had threatened to secede even as early as 1850. They threatened in 1856. And so a lot of Northerners just said, they're just the boy that cried wolf, right? They're just saying, well, here's another threat. But this time they actually do it. And so beginning on December 20th, 1860, South Carolina, which is the most radical of all the slaveholding states, South Carolina secedes. And then after that, six more do by February of 1861. I don't know the exact order, but it's basically the old Cotton Belt. South Carolina, Alabama, Georgia, Florida, Mississippi, Louisiana, and then Texas. Texas is the last one.
Well, a question for you to follow up, and we might get to this in the next point that you make on the evolution of the Confederate states. As they succeed, is this happening by happenstance? Is it state by state, or is there some sort of master plan that they're going to work together, or are they simply... Is there an assumption on the Confederate side that, well, the Union will not go, they will not go to war in order to reclaim us? So sort of the reverse of Northerners hoping that slavery will die a natural death, Southerners hoping, okay, we've crossed the Rubicon and they're not going to waste blood and treasure on bringing us back. What's their thinking as they're succeeding?
Well, the plan was always to unite and join together. They realized that you couldn't have the Republic of South Carolina and the Republic of Louisiana and the Republic of Florida. You know, that wasn't going to work. They needed to stick together. But they did secede individually one at a time because the state is the largest unit of sovereignty other than the federal government, of course, which they didn't respect anymore. So the states, very soon after the last one secedes, they joined together and found the Confederate States of America, and the capital is set for Montgomery, Alabama. And the Southern states, the Confederate states in particular, they start beefing up their militias. They form before long, there's a regular Confederate army. There's a Confederate Navy that takes a while to get going, but eventually it does. And so these state militias, they go around and they seize all federal property in the South, except for a handful of forts. For example, they're not able to take Fort Monroe in Virginia, which we will that'll have a big future. We'll talk about that later. Fort Pickens near Pensacola, Florida. But the most famous one is Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor. And Fort Sumter is out in the middle of the harbor, right smack in the middle on a man-made island. It wasn't even finished, but it was mostly done. And South Carolina sent a message to the commander of the fort and said, surrender. And he said, nope, I'm not going to do it. Now, it's interesting. There's so much irony in the Civil War, and I'm going to try to bring this out every chance I get. But the commander of the Confederate forces surrounding Fort Sumter was a man named General Pierre Gustave Touton Beauregard. That's my bad French accent. But he was a Creole from Louisiana. Beauregard had been an artilleryman, and he was so skilled as a student at West Point that his instructor at West Point kept him on as an assistant for another year. That instructor, ironically enough, was Major Robert Anderson, who was the commander of the Union troops inside Fort Sumter. So the student is about to fire upon the master.
Yeah, there's a lot of West Point back and forth in the upper ranks.
There is. We'll discuss this in more depth, but a lot of the men that end up becoming the senior generals on both sides were West Pointers. A lot of them had fought in the Mexican War. So anyway, Major Anderson, commander of Fort Sumter, who he was actually a Southerner. He was from Kentucky, but he was loyal to the Union. He refuses to surrender. Interestingly enough, I don't have this in the notes, but President Buchanan, this is when Buchanan, because one thing people may not know is that the president was elected in November, just as he is now. But back in these days, he did not take office until March. So there was a 4-month lame duck period. And Buchanan, before he went out of office, had tried to send reinforcements and supplies to the fort, but they were fired upon by the Confederate batteries, so they had to turn around and leave. Lincoln wanted to send food and medicine and non-military supplies, not soldiers, but just supplies, to Anderson, and he sent a ship, but before the ship could get there, on April 12, 1861, the Confederates began bombarding the fort. And only 34 hours later, Anderson ordered the fort surrender. The only casualty in the bombardment was a Confederate horse. And actually, there was a salute. There was a salute to the U.S. flag as it was coming down. And I think, if I remember correctly, a couple of guys were killed during just this like 21-gun salute or something. It's kind of terrible. All right, so that's Fort Sumter. Let's go on to the next part. So it surrenders on April 14th, and on April 15th, the very next day, Lincoln issues a proclamation asking for 75,000 volunteer soldiers to put down the rebellion. 75,000 doesn't seem like much to us, but we have to keep in mind that the United States Army at the beginning, at this time, only had about 16,000 troops total. The army was just tiny. And on top of that, most of the army soldiers were out in the West fighting the Indians, or at least doing frontier duty in the forts and things. So Lincoln realized, I've got to beef up my forces really quickly if I'm going to put this rebellion down. Well, the fact that Lincoln even asked for these volunteers, it triggers more secession. So the Upper South begins to go out. Virginia goes out 2 days later, then North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas. So now there's 4 more states added to the Confederacy. And I have to say that this makes the job of putting down the rebellion way harder, because these 4 states, especially North Carolina, Virginia, and Tennessee, are the most populous states. They bring a huge increase to the population of the Confederacy. They had most of the industrial capacity of the South. They had a lot of the mules and horses, and they just really were a huge bonus for the Confederacy. And the Confederate government decides to move the capital to Richmond, Virginia, which is not far from Washington, D.C. It's only about 100 miles south,
right?
90 to 100 miles. So it's kind of a symbolic thing. The Confederate government turns around and they call for 100,000 volunteers, and many, many more than that sign up. People sign up like crazy on both sides. Lincoln realizes I've got to have somebody really, really good to command my armies. So he offers field command of all Union armies to a colonel who had been out west. And this colonel's name was Robert E. Lee. Perhaps you've heard of him. Robert E. Lee is offered to be the head commander of all Union armies, but he declines. He says, I can't raise my hand against my native Virginia. And he resigns his commission and he becomes a Confederate general. Think how differently things might have turned out had Lee stayed loyal to the Union, but he didn't. And so there we go. That's all I have on the background. That's a really quick flyover. What do you think, Scott?
Well, here's something I'm curious about. There was a very high level of Confederate involvement. You mentioned there's over 100,000 volunteers. They exceed the call of troops. Many of them are poor. Many of them are farmers. And in a lot of the lore of the Confederacy, I still think there's this idea of the romantic idea of this poor Confederate soldier. And you imagine these reenactments where you hear this voiceover guy reading this letter, "Dear Susan, I sit here cold on my blanket," and there's this dirge music playing in the background. So a very romantic idea of the Confederate soldier. But here's something I wonder. What inflamed the passion so much for a poor Southerner to fight for the cause? In terms of economics, few Southerners were slaveholders because a slave was enormously expensive. I think it's maybe 20%, probably not even that much. And amongst those who did own slaves, these large plantations are a rarity. It's maybe a handful, yeah, up to a dozen. So your average Southerner has no involvement in slavery. Without him realizing it, could have very well seen his wages depressed because the cost of manual labor is being driven down. Yet many people are more than willing to fight and die to defend their homeland. So why is this? Do they somehow think that slavery is part of their identity, or would a Southerner understand it in terms of states' rights? Because that seems to be a contentious back and forth where maybe a more pro-Southern person would say, well, it was states' rights and slavery was incidental. And others would say, well, no, it really was slavery. So in terms of the passion that Southerners enter into the fray, what do you think explains that?
Well, one thing that is often overlooked is that even poor whites who had no slaves, probably never would have a slave, but they still had an interest in the slave system continuing, because one thing that slavery did is it made poor whites kind of not the bottom of the social rung. Well, not kind of, they were not. I'm not going to say it made them equal to the rich planters and all the big cheeses, but it made them to where at least they were better than somebody. Does that make sense?
Right.
So if slavery were to be abolished in the South, then they would all of a sudden be the low man on the totem pole. But this way, they weren't. And another thing, too, is that I read an interesting book when I was in grad school called Soul by Soul. It was about slave sales in particular. And the author mentions that pretty much every Southerner, even a poor person who had almost nothing, they still had the ambition to one day be a slaveholder, because to gain slaves was a way of saying, I've arrived. I am now not a poor dirt farmer anymore. I own this person. I bought them. It's just kind of like nowadays, if somebody shows up one day and they've got a Beamer, you know, or they've got a Mercedes or something like that, they've arrived financially. And it was a way that a poor Southerner could move up the social ladder and become, if not one of the top people, at least closer to the top. You also mentioned the homeland. That was another thing, too, is a lot of people were very much devoted to their state above and beyond the being devoted to the United States of America. We talked about Robert E. Lee. He says, I cannot raise my hand against my native Virginia. So Virginia comes first, the United States comes second. That was true for a lot of people, and especially in the South. And then the other thing is that Southerners just didn't like the idea that the North was going to come down and invade them. You know, Lincoln says, I need 75,000 troops to go put down this rebellion. And that seemed very wrong, very tyrannical to a lot of Southerners. There was one famous story where I can't remember which battle it was, but after one of the battles, somebody interviewed a Confederate soldier that they'd captured, and he was poor, and he didn't have any slaves, and they said, "Hey, you don't have any slaves. Why are you fighting?" He says, "I'm fighting because you're down here." So there were a lot of factors. I think that states' rights was important to a certain degree, although states' rights usually means the right to do something in particular. It only goes so far as an esoteric, abstract idea.
Well, there's a lot of factors here, and the stories of the slaves themselves is very important. And I guess I would refer people to previous episodes on this podcast that do get into antebellum slavery. It'll be hard to do that topic justice as we're focusing more on the battles. But of course, in the background and the linchpin of so much of what's happening, that's critical to understand. So I'd very much encourage people to read more and understand the slave experience and what it was like for the people there and how it affected social views. So as you said, James, that someone could at least aspire to a higher station in life and know that they weren't at the bottom of the social pyramid, that even when you're very poor and you're practically a sustenance farmer can inspire people in its own way. All right, well, that is the background. In the next episode, we're going to get to our first Civil War battle, the Battle of Bull Run. All right, well, that was the episode for today. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you want to support the show and help me keep producing this content, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, subscribe to the show and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to do that, you can go to historyunplugpodcast.com, and there you'll find instructions. Two, join our Facebook group, which you can find if you just search for History Unplugged. And please like and share posts that I put up about new episodes. This helps new people discover the show on social media. Three, submit a question to me so that I can answer it on air. You can email me at info@historyonthenet.com or leave a voicemail. And again, go to historyunplugpodcast.com and you'll find instructions. Lastly, and I think this one is the best, is to join the History Unplugged membership program. You can find out how by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Anyway, those are the ways you can help out the show. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word unplugged to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year, and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word unplugged to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word unplugged to 30605 and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text unplugged to 30605.